with Paul Stanley Hersey at Douglas Branch Library, Tuesday, March 2nd, 1982. The interviewer is Shirley Walker. Okay, Mr. Hersey, our primary interest in you is that you've been a lifelong resident of Champaign-Urbana, and you've probably seen many changes in this community. One of the first things we'd like to know is how your family came to Champaign-Urbana.
I'm not really sure. I think that my mother had a sister who lived in Decatur, and it was a part of them moving out of the South from Oklahoma, Mississippi, because that's where my father was from. And they were married in Oklahoma, then moved north in 1914. At that time, as you well know, conditions in the South weren't that good at that time. And I think a part of it was trying to get north where they thought conditions were better to get better jobs, etc.
Okay, tell us a little bit about your parents, their names, and your brothers and sisters, if you have any.
All right, my father's name was Edgar Calhoun Hersey. My mother's name was Caddy Yates Gray Hersey. I have four brothers and three sisters. Oldest sister is Mary L. Sullivan. And do you want something about what she does or
where she lives?
She lives in Chicago, teaches school. My next oldest sister is Dorothy Moses. She also lives in Chicago. And my youngest sister is Betty Hersey, who lives in Urbana. My oldest brother is Charles Hersey, lives in Urbana. Next oldest brother is George Hersey, who also lives in Urbana. My third oldest brother was Dave Hersey, and he died 2 years ago. Then myself, and my youngest brother is Julius Hersey, who also lives in Urbana.
So is it safe to say that pretty much all the Herseys who are black and live in Champaign are related?
That's for sure.
You were born in 1930. So you've seen Champaign-Urbana change for 50 years. One thing that I've noticed from reading the statistical information available is that there seems to be quite a large number of black people, percentage-wise, as compared to 25, 30, 40 years ago. How do you see that?
Well, that's true. When I went to grade school, what is now King School at that time was Hayes School. And in Urbana at that time, I would venture to say there were 12, 13 families at the most. Hayes School was a totally integrated school. Totally integrated to the point that all the black kids that lived in that immediate area had to go to Hayes School. There was another school, Lincoln School, which was located just a few blocks south of Hayes School. And there were some families who lived in that area too. The wards, primarily, that I remember, and their kids went to Lincoln School. During the late 40s and early 50s, there was an influx of blacks into the Champaign-Urbana community, and what is now King School, you began to see the pattern changing as far as black families in what they termed the north end of Urbana and Champaign, with more black children going to it was still Hayes School at that time. And finally, in the early 60s, it was very noticeable because during that period of time, not only had the school changed, but the neighborhood had changed. There had been what we termed at that time some block busting in the area around Hayes School. One family sold their house right across from Hayes School to Loretta Scott, who also was a local resident and had married Arthur Davis. And all of a sudden you saw for sale signs every place. at that time also, I think I was serving on one of the school committees, and we did a study of black population in the Urbana schools and the numbers of black kids who were actually graduating from high school, and it was 0 percentile. We then looked at Hayes School and decided, well, at that time Hayes School was something like 98% black, and it was our assumption that our kids were not getting the proper education and so forth, and we went through this stage of what we term desegregation, and whether it's worked or not is something that I don't think we'll ever know, but at least we went to the board. They then determined that they would bus the kids from Archer Downs into King School, and the kids from King School would be put into the other districts and other schools in the district. But I think over the period of time, say from 1940 through 1968-69, there was a real change in the not only in the housing in the black community, but also in the numbers of black people who came from all over the country. Really, that's what it boils down to.
You mentioned and talking about black people, that area in which you live. So in what part of Urbana did you grow up in and live?
Basically the same area, about four blocks south. Our old home was on Hill Street, 1408 Hill Street, and my sister still lives there. And all of us within a radius of two blocks. I remember hearing my mother talk about 706 North Romine, which is just down the corner. We then moved to 1402 West Hill Street, and then from there to where the house is now, 1408 Hill Street. So, you know, I was born and raised right in that basic immediate area. At that time, if you live, you basically didn't live south of University Avenue. All the blacks live north of University Avenue, and primarily between Wright Street and Goodwin.
Okay, now you also mentioned, you use the word influx of black people, and with several people, for several people with whom we've talked, they've used that same word, influx. Some people use it like it was bad, and others, you know, just what the word means. So is that the standard term that was applied to black people coming in, especially from the South? And then to what was the community feeling, in your opinion, about all the black people who were coming in?
Well, you know, I think this really started right after World War II. And, you know, in my own opinion, I don't look at it as being a bad thing. I think it was a very positive thing. For one reason, I think those residents who had been here for many years, when you looked around and you started trying to identify what you might term old-time residents, it became very difficult to do that. I recall in particular when I went to, was in the Korean War, and I went into service in 1951. You could pretty much walk down the street and call each other by name. I came back in 1953, and it was entirely different. I knew a lot of the people, but there were a lot of people that I didn't know. I think, you know, particularly black people were trying to better themselves, and this community appeared to be a community to settle in which the opportunities might have been a little better from whence they came.
You later moved to what's called Ellis Division in Urbana, and you and your family were one of the early residents of that division, is that right?
That's right.
Okay, now can you tell me a little bit about how Ellis started and the changes that you've seen?
Well, strange, Ellis Subdivision used to be what we used to call Mr. Pete's Field, where he grew corn and the normal kinds of crops that are good for this area. And prior to Ellis Subdivision, Attucks subdivision was built. And some of the younger married couples at that time had settled in attics. Strangely enough, my wife and I had tried to get a lot in attics. Well, when we found out what was going on, all but one of the lots had been sold. And we were struggling at that time and couldn't even come up with the money to buy the lot that was left. About 4 or 5 years later, they started developing Ellis Drive. And we were one of the first couples to apply for a lot. Having been in service, I went directly to the Veterans Administration and applied for a GI loan to get my lot and to build my house. And many of the other young couples, guys that I had grown up with, were moving right into the Ellis subdivision also. It did two things, I think, for the North End. One, most of us at that time had young kids, and for some reason or another, we were able to coalesce and provide something like a power base for the black community in Urbana. In particular, in the political arena, felt like Carlos Donaldson and Herb Nesbitt, Lonnie Clark, we were all looking for something to hang on to make sure that our kids receive what we thought that they should be receiving from our community. So it provided somewhat of a political base. And in 1963 or 64, we had noticed a lot of things going on in our area, primarily in the realm of not being done by our city, such as our streets being cleaned, the snow being cleaned, just the general kinds of things, the services that you would expect from the city and that you're paying taxes. So we formed what we call the Hayes Grove Neighborhood Association. If you don't know anything about the city of Urbana, at that time they were in an old community building. That's where they conducted their city council meetings. And it's like in the 1890s, they had spittoons and hardback chairs and everything. So we started going to city council meetings and saying to them, you know, that we live in an area where we're paying taxes. We expect the same services from the city as you give other places. And from that, we had an alderman at that time by the name of Don Harlow. And Don was white, had watched the majority of us grow up because we all went to Hayes School. And we first approached Don to see if he would, as our alderman, would go to the council and take our concerns to the council. And he told me in a meeting once, he had a gas station, he said, I could go to city council and talk to them blue in the face and they would not do anything for this area. Well, you know, that led us then to believe that we had to do something in electing someone from our own area. I then petitioned for candidacy in the primary one, and then I beat him by 9 votes in the general election. And that from that time on, our ward was represented, well, there was another black man who was on the council at that time. He ran the next election time and was defeated by Fred Walden. So we had 2 black council persons. And then from that time on until just recently, we've always had a black representative from our area.
So in what year did you and your family move to Ellis?
1962. We lived in Champaign, down on Park Street, 507 East Park Street, the first 7 years of our marriage. And then when Ellis Addition came open, we moved there in 62. I think it took them a year to build the house, and we moved in 62.
You just mentioned something about your running for and elected to Urbana as an Urbana councilman. Tell us something about your campaign and how you were assisted, and then your reception by the all-white council as the first black councilman.
It was difficult at first. I thought I had a very good campaign. I had a lot of people assisted me when I was running for alderman. A strange thing about it, this area that I lived in had primarily been Republican, and many of our black residents had always voted Republican. In fact, the year that I ran, one of our closest family friends was a precinct committeeman, and she was Republican, and she campaigned for my opponent, only to find out that she was taking black people to the polls to vote, and they were voting for me instead of voting for Don Harlow. But the kids assisted me. They handed out leaflets. I probably knocked on every door in the ward. And, you know, black people and white people. My basic concern was that I felt that the city was not providing the proper services and adequate services. And in our area in particular, it didn't make any difference whether you were black or white. The area was identified as being in the north end of Urbana, and had historically not been served well by the city. So many of the white residents could, what I was saying, they could understand why I was taking that as a political position. Another thing was occurring at that time. They were building the new city building, and they have a granite stone over there with every alderman's name on it at that time. And the concern was from the white community that Don Harlow had been alderman for 16 years, and here we were building this new city building, and there was going to be a black man's name put in the stone over there. It was really funny. And then when they finally dedicated the building, and you know, everybody dumped their little bit into the cornerstone, the box that goes into the cornerstone, and I took a clipping out of the paper where his daughter had really lashed out at me in the news, and the news media talked about the little colored boy who had a snotty nose and had walked up to her daddy's candy counter and put his penny on the counter and asked for a penny's worth of candy. It was really comical, really. But at that time, there were four Democrats on the council, and it was difficult getting a lot of the things that we had worked for through the council. One of the primary things we were working for at that time was a Human Relations Commission, and that's back in the mid-60s. I thought we had support from a very influential person, the individual being the general manager of Carson Perry Scott. They had just also built Lincoln Square, only to find out that it got voted down 11-3 at the council meeting. But I think at that point in time, we were going through some serious changes in Urbana, in the political arena, as well as in the educational arena.
How long did you serve on the council?
The first time I served for a little over 2.5 years. I then took a job as director of the county poverty program. And legally, it was determined that to be director of the poverty program for the county and to serve on the city council at the same time was a conflict of interest, because I had to deal, you know, with the city council, I had to deal with the county board, and it was necessary for me to resign from the council. And so I did resign from the council because I felt a couple of things. One, being director of the poverty program, I could do a lot more in trying to help my people. And secondly, it also was an opportunity for advancement for myself. And I always had to keep my family in mind as well. So I resigned from the council in 1967, I think it was, 1966, because I became director of the county poverty program in 66.
Okay, so in 66 you resigned from the council. And when is the next time you were a part of the Urbana City Council?
Well, during that period between 66 and 72, In 1968, the Democratic Party was looking for a candidate for mayor. And I had just thrown my hat in the ring, just kind of cordially, you know, because they said, you know, we're going to interview potential candidates and select a Democratic candidate to run. When I found out what had happened, they had selected G. Marie Weil to run for mayor against Charlie Zipro. And nobody had said anything to me at all. So about four days before you had to have your petitions in, I went over and got a petition. And you don't identify when you go in, you don't have to identify what you're running for. And the last day to file your petitions, I filed my petitions for mayor, which presented a conflict within the Democratic Party. G. Marie Weil, her program and my program were very much alike. We had debates on the radio and so forth and so on. And she beat me in the primary by 31 votes. And all of those, I was leading her up until her ward came and she beat me by 31 votes. And the purpose of that, I didn't expect to get nominated to go into the general election, because the party said they didn't take any stand, but I knew full well by their selection of G. Marie Weil that they were going to support her. But the part in doing that was to basically say to this community that we as black folks think the same way that you do. We have the same aspirations. And knowing full well that I would not win the primary. Then in 1972, I ran for the council again. I had not, after running for mayor, I had not intended on going back into politics, because in my own analysis of politics, it's a very dirty game. You've got to, if you don't play the game the way most people play it, you always lose. And I'm not used to playing the dirty game under the table and those kinds of things. But in 1972, I was asked by a group of people if I would consider running again. And so I did. I ran again in 1972. And I ran against a young black lady, Doris Williams. I beat Doris in the primary and again beat the Republican guy, and Doris ran on a write-in vote in the general election, and I beat both of them in the general election as well. At that time, we had a majority of Democrats on the council. I think there were 8 Democrats and 6 Republicans. And Hiram Paley was elected as mayor. Well, come to find out that the Democratic contingency on the council were having meetings on Saturday mornings, and I was being left out. And I raised quite a bit of hell about that, and Hiram and I just didn't, his philosophy of, his political philosophy and mine did not travel the same lines. After 3 years on the council, I left the council, and I have no intentions of running again for any political office.
History interview with Paul Stanley Hersey. The date is Monday, October the 25th, 1982. The interview is taking place at Douglas Branch Library. We talked about your family and how they came here, your brothers and sisters, and your involvement with the Urbana City Council and in politics. And during the course of this part, we've hit on a couple of things that you've done in the job line since you've lived here. So can you tell us something about the kinds of jobs you've had and how you see those jobs in terms of black people and employment areas open to blacks in Urbana?
I got out of service in December of 1953. Went to work in January or February of that year at Douglas Center as assistant director. At that time, Lee Carey was director. The following September, Lee left Douglas Center and went to Springfield, and I was then moved up to director of Douglas Center. Stayed there until January or February of 1960. Moved then to the University of Illinois as a mail messenger. occupied that job for approximately 6 years. Then moved to director of the poverty program for Champaign County. Took a year's leave of absence from the university. Returned back to the university in 67 into the personnel office as a personnel officer, primarily in the recruiting of black employees. Stayed there for a year, was then made university campus affirmative action officer. Then I left the university in 1969. I purchased a bookbindery, left the university, purchased some equipment for the bookbindery, stayed in that business for about a year and a half, and then returned to the university. Didn't sell the business. My wife continued the business until 1978. Went back to the university then in the functioning area of classification and salary. Stayed there for 2 years, was then moved into labor and employee relations, and at that time became associate director for campus personnel. Did all the contract negotiations, collective bargaining, grievances, etc. In 1980, I then moved to the University Office of Personnel as coordinator of labor and employee relations for the university, which encompasses Urbana and the two campuses in Chicago, and also as associate director. What else? But going back to Douglas Center, I think everyone knows that at that time it was basically, and still is, black oriented, built in 1945, and has served the community well. After moving from Douglas Center, I became a mail messenger. At that time, at the University of Illinois, there was definitely a problem as far as black employment. Within this particular unit, there were 9 or 10 mail messengers, and they were all black. There is a history to this particular function at the university. Years ago, an individual named Mr. Scott was basically a runner for the president.
You know his first name, Mr. Scott? Is that Irma Bridgewater's father?
Right.
Raymond Scott.
Raymond E. Scott Sr.
Okay.
Was basically a runner for the president. And from from that position came the mail messengers. His son worked there, another individual, George Evans. Initially, I think there were four, including Mr. Scott. George Evans, Raymond Scott Jr., Nate Banks, Clarence Taylor, and Mr. Scott, there were five. Always had, from the university standpoint, just a super record as far as delivering the mail. That then became a bigger organization as a university group, and I was employed. Another fellow, Carlos Donaldson, Jim Miner, who is now a carpenter, John Thompson, who is also now in the carpenter shop, and I don't know, I've lost track of who works there now. Early in 1965 or 66, when they started talking about affirmative action at the university, it was determined that they would also integrate the university mail service. And at that time, I think they brought in two white individuals, male individuals, to work within the organization. As a personnel officer recruiter, during the period of time when I was director of the poverty program, I set up two employment stations in the black community, one being at the old OIC building on Fifth Street. And at that time, we had a storefront on Washington Street. And we did recruiting from the university 2 days a week. Two individuals from the personnel office came out and did recruiting in the black community. After going back to the university as a personnel officer, I kept those two places open. And then I came out here and I interviewed and did the testing out here and did a few other things internally that hopefully were assisting blacks in getting employment. Of course, in the area of classification salary, that's not a whole heck you can say about that. You review jobs, set salaries, and basically that's the extent of it. Going into the bindery business was a new, something new for me, primarily because one, at that point in time, I had the only book bindery in the local community. I thought that I was going to be able to go back to the university and get the business from the university library. Applied for a small business loan and was turned down. Turned down by a black individual in Springfield. Found out pretty quickly that we weren't turning the books over quickly enough to maintain my household. And so I returned back to the university into the personnel office.
Why did you open the bindery? Did you have some experience in bookbinding, or you decided that might be a good business, or what?
Well, back in 1964 or 65, I went in jointly with another black individual, Donald Alexander. And during the period of Donald and his father and myself had a partnership. And it created some real problems with Donald and his father, so I stepped out. Left my investment there and stepped out. Well, in 1968, Donald lost the bookbindery. And the guy that owned the building over on Lincoln Avenue bought it. Then I went in behind and bought it from this white guy on Lincoln Avenue in 1969. So I did have, for about a year and a half, I worked in the bindery. We did everything by hand at that time. We did sewing by hand, and all of it was what you might term fine binding. But after purchasing the bindery for myself, I thought if we mechanized the bindery, we could produce books much quicker. But, you know, equipment costs a lot of money also. I think our initial investment was something like $30,000. But it still wasn't good enough to get the business from the university. I had to leave the university primarily because as an employee of the university, I could not contract work from the university. That's one of the university rules. So that was one of the reasons why I left the university. We kept the bindery for, 9 years. My wife hired two other individuals, and she worked in the bindery, and we eventually sold it in 1978.
Is it still open?
Still open. The young fellow that's running it now was one of the individuals that my wife hired when I left, and he does a very good job.
You mentioned an organization, the Hayes School Neighborhood Association, and you went into that. Okay, and I've also heard you mentioned another organization, BACKUP, Black Action Council for United Progress. Will you tell us something about that and what was the purpose behind it?
Yeah, the Hayes School Neighborhood Association was formed basically for two reasons. One, when Ellis Addition was first built, they were moving old houses from the University of Illinois back up into the north end of Urbana. A fellow by the name of Henson was doing this, was converting these houses into apartments and renting these apartments to black families at exorbitant prices. Another reason was, in moving these houses, they came right through Ellis Addition. We had blacktop streets and just ruined our streets. So the second reason for forming the Hayes School Neighborhood Association was for the desegregation of schools. It worked. We had maybe 7 or 8 real active members, but no one knew how many were in the organization. We just said Hayes School Neighborhood Association, and of course that encompassed the people from Lincoln Avenue to Wright Street and from the university back to Bradley. We did stop the moving of houses. Henson at one time was moving 3 houses at one time. We blocked the streets. Everybody went to work that morning, put their cars, parked their cars legally in the Ellis subdivision, which prohibited him from moving the houses during that day. The Hayes School Neighborhood Association went to the school board in 66, I think it was, and that was the year that what is now King School was Hayes School, then was desegregated. So it was twofold purpose there with the Hayes School Neighborhood Association. Backup was an organization that Reverend Offit and myself put together back in 68, 69, and the purpose for that was to try to get all of the black organizations in the two communities to come together. NAACP, the Ministerial Alliance, Hayes School Neighborhood Association, and to act as one group on major problems such as schools, housing, and any other major problem that was facing both communities. Jim and I went to the Baptist Synod, and
okay, now Jim is
Jim Offit, Reverend Offit, and obtained, and I can't remember. I think it was like $9,000 or $10,000 for administrative purposes for this Black Action Council of United Progress. Once we got the money for the organization, for all practical purposes,
excuse me,
he and I kind of backed away from it. And if I recall, we did get a building. We got a building down on Fifth Street. It used to be the old grain building down on between Park and University Avenue on Fifth Street. We got the building, and then we backed away from it. Stevie Jackson was the first, if you want to call it, director, was the first director. Backup then became backed up. we really didn't foresee what was going to happen with the organization, and Backup then eventually became the Black Coalition. And again, you know, number wise, initially in Backup we did have members who were heads of the various organizations such as Urban League, NAACP, Hayes School Neighborhood Association, Ministerial Alliance, but everybody just seemed to back away from it after Stevie took over as director. And Jim and I did not intercede and try to change it at all. Probably an error on our part, but we didn't.
Okay, overall, we've covered several things. Overall, what do you see as the changes that have taken place for black people in Champaign-Urbana? And we touched on a few things with the schools and in Ellis, but from just the time you were a kid to the present in terms of, say, general employment and housing, education, like was the university open to students, you know, how many black students, not exact numbers, but, you know, sizable amount of students went to the university or whatever. We've done a lot of taping that carries us from, say, about 1900 up to the 50s. But most of those people that we taped, by the time the 50s rolled in, mid-50s, they were in their 60s, late 50s, early 60s, and they had kind of wound down on what they were doing, so that they're not as aware of what was going on, you know, after the influx and whatever.
Well, it seems to me, speaking in the area of education, when I started school at the university, no black students stayed on campus. All of the black students stayed in town with families whose homes were either made into apartments or they rented rooms. And no black students stayed on campus.
Excuse me, did you attend the university?
Right. And certainly since that time, the university is open to black students to live in the residence halls, et cetera. I think in the area of local education, and you know, I don't know one way or another. It seems to me that when I went through the Urbana school system, and maybe I was naive at that time, but I thought, one, I got a good education. The schools at that time were integrated. There were no segregated schools at the time. Hayes School was integrated. The junior high, which was Thornburn, was integrated. The high school was integrated.
Okay, excuse me a minute. Looking back on it, why do you think they were so, and I assume, well integrated at that time?
Well, the housing patterns were different for one reason. In the north end of Urbana, you had a mixture of black and white families. To say the least, most of the white families were of the lower wage levels. And that's basically, I guess, why they lived in the north end of Urbana. But you can look on the other side of Route 45 north also, and you saw very poor white families as well.
Criminal Hill.
Right. What's referred to as Criminal Hill. But I think, you know, in the north end of Urbana in particular, there was the integrated, of course, that's where all the blacks lived at that time too, but that was an integrated area and an integrated school.
Now, excuse me again, were those, the schools were integrated, you mentioned Thornburn and Hayes. Was Thornburn the only junior high school at the time?
That was the only junior high school at the time.
So, in essence, they were integrated, it was the only school. But there was never any attempt at that time to establish a separate school for blacks.
No.
Do you think that part of that is because there were so few blacks?
It could have been that, plus the fact in those days, blacks, basically all your blacks lived north of University Avenue. You found very few that lived south of University Avenue or east of Lincoln Avenue. So when I speak of the north end, that's where the bulk of the black families lived. It was a little different when you went to Thornburn Junior High School, because for the most part, kids who went to the other schools, such as Lille and at that time there wasn't any Wiley School, Lille and Weber, had basically not had a great deal of contact with other black students. But on the other hand, it didn't appear that they didn't accept you at that time either. And as you say, it might be because there were so few black kids at that time who moved through the school system. In my graduating class from high school, there were five blacks who were eligible to graduate, and four of us graduated out of 155, 156. So the ratio there, percentage-wise, is very low.
Okay, as opposed to now, where there are percentage-wise more
certainly
students.
Right.
Something else that I know I ask a question and you partially answered, but it brings to mind another question that may help answer the first one. You mentioned that there were white families who lived in the general area as well as black families. And in interviewing some other people, they made references to being integration for all practical purposes. It was, there was integration, rather, in the neighborhood. And it seemed to be the same thing, that there were so few blacks at the time, there was no need to separate. There wasn't that strength in numbers or whatever. Do you feel that played any part in the way the housing pattern, say when you were growing up?
Yeah, I think the fewer number of blacks, as they may think, we were not a threat to them at that time. Certainly as the influx of blacks into the community began to occur, and the housing patterns, you could very clearly then define the housing patterns, because in the north end of Urbana, we saw more blacks moving in, and at that time, you saw whites leaving the north end and moving to other areas.
And these were new blacks coming into town.
New blacks coming into town.
Influx blacks.
Right. I recall I went into service in 1951, and prior to that time, you could basically walk down the street and call everybody by name. I got out of service in 1953. And it was just completely different. in two and a half years' time, you could see the numbers changing, faces changing, and you didn't know as many people. Of course, I took into account the fact that I'd been gone for 2 years also, but there was definitely a major influx in blacks in both the Champaign and Urbana areas, and most of them stayed right in the north end of Urbana and or Champaign.
Now, what about in employment?
I really don't perceive any real major changes. Most of your blacks, as they were in the early 50s, still work in the service areas. There have been some breakthroughs in some professional positions, some in the craft and trade area, but if you look at the numbers of blacks who have come here, who have the qualifications, I think we're still way low as far as employment is concerned in certain areas. Certainly the program at the university that brought in black students, we see more black students on campus now. This is not to say that the treatment is any different. I think a part of that is that you can attribute to the fact that the university, in order to maintain their level of federal funding, has played a major role into this. And I don't know that the black students who are at the university now are any better off than the black students who were at the university when I was in school. And you're talking about maybe 30 or 40 black students when I was in school, as opposed to, what, 600 or 700 students now?
About 1,500 or so. And just overall, well, one thing, about to say overall, there's another area in just the time I've been here, I don't see any real black institutions other than the churches. And by the institutions, I mean the general things you find in the black community. There are no clubs, no hangouts, you know, the kinds of things that you find. Were there more institutions, say, prior to the last 10 years or so, or what, or has it always been like this?
Well, there used to be, a University Elks Club that went defunct. There used to be also, when I was a teenager, a couple of restaurants where you could go and sit down and feel fairly reasonably safe. For an example, Joe Summers had a place both on Grove Street in Champaign and then again on the corner of 4th and Washington. There used to be a little place over in Urbana we called Mr. Lides, and you could go there and get a hamburger and dance and have a pretty good time. Here recently, though, as you said, the real institution now in the black community is the church. And it's always, of course, the church has always been there. You don't find that many black businesses that are in the black community. There are a couple located outside. Of course, you know, we got the store on 4th Street. But for some reason or another, we've not, in the black community, we have not materialize those kinds of institutions. There, the clubs, well, there are a couple of, I mean, I don't know if you call them clubs, they're basically social kinds of clubs, the one Saturday Nighters and then the Cavalier.
But they're more organizational as opposed to physical places,
right? That's right.
Where people can go.